striking its visitants with a strong and melancholy reflection, that such is the abodes of the dead, thy inevitable doom, O stranger, soon to be numbered as one of them. So it reads in the field book. They handed that in, Ethelmer in surprise. Part of the official record, Uncle Ives' eyebrows descending. However, where Mason saw a Gothic interior, Dixon saw upon every surface ancient inscriptions, glyphs unreadable, Ogham possibly. Mr. Shockey has little to add. The Indians, it seems like, they stayed away from there, bad spirits or something. So if it's writing, it'd have to be older than them. Could have been Welsh Indians, offers one of his sons, moved on west long before our time, said to be crossed beyond the Illinois. You'll be seeing Captain Shelby soon. He knows more. Mason is looking about, precisely like someone planning to furnish a room. Nor summer's heat, he will whisper later that night, unable to quit the fire, nor winter's freeze need bother us, snug in the earth, those ceilings, high as heaven. Dixon is not quite so entertained. The cave oppresses him. He has mentally measured it, as surveyors do, and is trying to imagine what form of life might be calling something as spacious as this home, and what might become of the Anglican population out here should the dweller show up unexpectedly one Sunday during the service. All the way back to the Visto, Mason is seized by monology. Text, he cries, and more than once, it is text, and we are its readers, and its pages are the day's turning. Unscrolling as a pilgrim's itinerary map in ancient days. And this is the chapter called The Subterranean Cathedral, or The Lesson Grasped. You must make sure I do not attempt to return. Didn't you feel anything? You people with your second sight and eldritch powers, why, I've seen better at Painswick Fair. A lad brings in a well or two, and right away 'tis wizard me this, wizard me the. Can you stretch me a bit of chain today, do you guess? Thank thee for asking. I'd been planning to crowd thee. They neck rein their horses in opposite directions, till they're as far apart upon the road as they can manage, and continue their return from the world beneath the world to the line beneath the stars. Chapter 52. The crossing of Conococheague, with its dismal history, proves particularly unsettling. Providentially, no 10 minutes of arc terminate upon either bank. That burned and bloody little huddle of cabins can provide no object of pilgrimage. Any prospect of lingering as much as a fortnight among these ghosts and the desolation in which they wait would have sent the expedition on to some station less haunted, extra chaining and calculating and all. Lancaster, as a scene of horror, had been bearable because of the secular town upon every side, pursuing its business, begging attendance at every turn. Yet what in Lancaster was but an hour's thrill, out here in this sternly exact desert, might become an uncontrollable descent into whatever the Visto was supposed to deny, the covetousness of all that lived, that continued to press in at either side, wishing simply to breach the long rectified absence wherever it might, to insist upon itself. Between two roads leading to different ferries across Potomac, they calculate and change course, and at last, 117 miles, 12 chains, and 97 links west of the postmarked west, they fetch up against the flank of the North Mountain, having entered the personal zone of influence of Captain Evan Shelby. They pack the instruments and leave them in his care for the winter. Not till they turn and head east again do they find any time for remembering anything. Going west has been all futurity. Now, moving against the sun, they may take up again the past. Trudging one day into the wind, all hats impossible, hair in streams, struggling to keep the brass instrument on its tripod over one shoulder, Dixon at last saw the logic of Emerson's notorious back-to-front coat. Of course 'tis back-to-front, Emerson had sighed. Plutonians give some brain to it. In all animals, isn't it the ventral or belly side that needs most protection, the dorsal or backside being stronger and harder? And won't half the walking I'm to do in my life be into the wind? Bonnie. At such times, then, I'd rather be a few degrees above freezing, thank ye, and let me back look after itself. Then why does everyone else go about with coats open in front? Emerson gazed upon the assembled young scholars with a great pretense of mildness and forbearance. My entire life as a teacher, lesson after futile lesson, is time thus pitiably squandered, an old man's folly. Not that I ever was a teacher, really. I'm a man of science, between patrons at the moment, only doing this so I can pay my laboratory expenses, though Mrs. Emerson takes a slightly different view. 'Tis the Grub Street of philosophy, she laments. Durham Prison were better. Howsoever, the question, mercifully, was not about marriage. The modern coat, as we know it, he explained, is based upon the attire of the nobility and gentry and other assorted thieves who could ever afford servants to put their clothes on for them. At such intimate moments, 'twas believed more prudent to keep a servant in front of one than allow him behind. For today's discussion, therefore, speculate for me, if yous will, what might have happened to the structure of England had everything fastened in back, obliging servants, let us here include America, the Indies, and black slaves as well, to spend more time behind their masters than before, and so close as to be invisible. Long before the soldiers came in sight, people in their path could hear the drums, upon fitfully directed winds, clattering off the walls of old quarries where weld flowered in glows of orange, yellow, and green, raking the hillside pastures all but empty with the lambs just sold, and the breeding ewes resting up for winter, their culled sisters off to auctions and fates less ritual, whilst the rams were soon to go up to spend winter in the hills. Vast flights of starlings, fleeing the racket, beat across the sky at high speed, like squall clouds, evening at noontide. In the little one-street villages, women stood among the laundry they just put out, looking at the light, reckoning drying time and marching time and cloud speed, and how wet everything might be when they'd have to bring it in again. Soon, the mercilessly even drumbeat filled the day, replacing the accustomed rhythms of country people with the controlling pulse of military clock time, announcing that all events would now occur at the Army's pleasure upon the Army's schedule. Then they began with the bagpipes. For demonstrative purposes, Wolfe, from time to time in the easy march up to Stroud, would order his troopers to dismount, take up skirmish positions, and fire at whatever took their fancy. Later, in Pennsylvania, deep within the glades of death, crossing the road upon which Braddock and his forces had met their unhappy end, Mason would wonder if the effects of the late tragedy in America upon Army morale in general and upon Wolfe in particular might not also have played their part in this idle musketry, which left splashed behind them a path scarlet with hundreds of small, innocent lives, wild and domestic, far beneath the notice of a dragoon, of course, but often of moment to local residents. The fowl running into the fields, no sleep for fear of everything that might happen. For all we know, Wolfe may have felt the same contempt for British weavers as did Braddock for American Indians. Treacherous natives, disrespectful, rebellious, waiting an ambuscado behind every stone wall. British firing upon British, Dixon charging his pipe absently. I thought that was all done with. Are your weavers Jacobites then? They're people, Dixon, whom I saw daily. They worked, they ate when they came off shift, good for a cob or a batch loaf a day, or a mason's bap. That was my dad's own specialty, baked upon the bottom of the oven, white flour in clouds. He'd sell them whole or by the slice. Some aspired to be master weavers. Most would have settled for a living wage. But their desires, how betrayed, when in 56 the justices of the peace, upon easily imagined arrangements with the clothiers, reduced by half the wages set by law, and the troubles came to a head. He pauses, as if reaching a small decision. Rebecca's people were weavers. Dixon, lighting his pipe, hadn't known that. Wool workers upon her father's side, silk upon her mother's. She liked to say it accounted for the way she was. Dixon puffs, nodding slowly, evenly, eyes crossed as if scrying in the glow of his pipe bowl. And that wondrous night, in the high street, they were all there, brothers and cousins and uncles. Mason's pause seems but for breath, though Dixon already is beaming an unmistakable inquiry. I was there, now that I think of it. Dixon nods. Been out upon the pavement myself. Tyne Keelmen, back in 50. No business over there, understand. None at all, yet. Mason reaches for his pipe. Oh, aye. More than once, perhaps. I have looked on worlds far distant, their beauty how pitiless. Yeah, that night. The streets, Jerry. Thousands of angry men in streets that ordinarily see no more than, a dozen a day. 'Twas backed up to Slad Brook. It spilled out into both branches of the High Street. He puffs in a sub-merriment Dixon recognizes. Down the lower street and up Parliament and all that hillside between. Torches everywhere, looms dressed in mourning, songs of the 45, they're throbbing within those prim corridors of stone, how savage. Effigies of hated master weavers, hanged in their own bar chains, so dishonorably set. And the murmur, ever, unceasingly, the great, crisp, serene roar of a mobility focused upon a just purpose. Aye, of course, in Newcastle, 'twas more the brick type of wall, quite different sound, more like Philadelphia. What did they do in Durham with the ones they caught? The keelmen? Transported? I know, not as entertaining as the gallows in Painswick. Yet, as we aren't quite such devotees of the noose in Durham, a good many Tyneside keelmen ended up in America. Hereabouts, in fact. If we'd stopped longer in Philadelphia, we'd have run into a few of them by now. And would I have enjoyed that? Thou might not have been alone. I mean, of course, having at the last minute decided they weren't thy sort, all that coal grime and ale drinking and such, nor as clean as thy loom worker out there by the babbling brook, neat as a pin and all. Wait, you're saying that ceteris paribus, the company of keelmen, is preferable to that of weavers? That's clearly impossible, for it is widely allowed that weavers are the soul of jollification. You've nothing in Gloucester, nay, nor in the kingdom, to match the night Billy Snowball thought the old clasher's head was an ale can. Hey, hey, hey. Mason gazes until the laughter subsides, though evidently a source of cheery memories for you. Kept grabbing him by his nose. What's this, eh, eh? Yet in Stroud, how ill-advised, even in so tolerant and cosmopolitan a room as the George Inn. Where, let us recall, back in 56, thou witnessed a congress of clothiers leaping from the upstairs windows. Thank ye, some indeed with their punch cups still upon their fingers and lit pipes in their mouths, and the cards scattering everywhere. At home he found his father in some anxiety. Weavers a riot, troops coming in. I ought to stay then. What'll you do, point your telescope at them? You'll be worse than useless. They'll shoot you the moment you present them with that vacant face. Perhaps I can ask them at Greenwich for another. Release yourself. Your mother and I will get through. Between the thieving mob and the thieving soldiers, there are still places to hide an odd loaf. But you, better that you repair to Greenwich, Kent, young sir, remain upon your hilltop, far from this poor, defeated place. He sought his mother's eyes, receiving only a quick sweep, as from a broom, her face distressed, as if whispering, "You see how you distress him?" The open countryside seemed made only to pull coal out of and run a few sheep on, and to harbor all the terrors imaginable to a boy. I was only comfortable in the towns, Dixon one day would admit, or in Raby, protected by the castle, yet never cared for the territory between. Mason looks on in some perplexity. Rum affliction for a surveyor, isn't it? Say that it provided me an incentive to enclose that which had hitherto been without form, and hence haunted by anything and everything, if you grasp my meaning, anything and everything, sir. I was well acquainted with such terrors, whilst yet I crept and babbled, sir. Despite the road, steep and toilsome, was I taken, like most children born in that part of Bisley Parish, truly bouncing babies all, to Sapperton Church to be christened. For Bisley lies across a great treeless plain, known at our end as Oak Ridge Common, and at the other as Bisley Common, haunted by wild men and murderers, and its wind never ceasing, a source of limitless fear. Cockfield fell to the double dot, Dixon recalls. Everyone put in great effort to avoid crossing it. When I got older and began watching the stars, of course, 'twas another story. The sky was suddenly all there in its full display. I couldn't wait for night to be out under it. Stop, I'm a shiver now. Nothing for miles, unprotected neath those leagues innumerable, in which at any moment... Dixon, to appearance in a true panic, runs about the tent looking for some place to hide, and finding nothing but a feed sack handy, attempts to insert himself into it. Emerson smoked it all right away. If it's but the empty places between the towns, he advised Dixon, your worries are at an end, for look what you can do. You can get above it. He spoke these words with an emphasis Dixon cannot describe the full strangeness of. Something was up, as so shortly would he and his classmates be, but before they'd learn to fly, they had to learn about maps, for maps are the aide-mémoire of flight. So Dixon came to discover, as well, the great invariance, whereby aloft one gains exactitude of length and breadth, only to lose much of the land's relievo, or dimension of height, whilst back at ground level, traveling about the country, one regains bodily the realities of up and down, only to lose any but a rough sense of the other two dimensions, now all about one. Earthbound, Emerson continued, we are limited to our horizon, which sometimes is to be measured but in inches. We are bound withal to time and the amounts of it spent getting from one end of a journey to another. Yet aloft, in map space origins, destinations, any termini hardly seem to matter. One can apprehend all at once the entire plexity of possible journeys, set as one is above distance, above time itself. Altitude, cried out a couple of alert youths, as in Emerson's class they were encouraged to do. Altitude being the price we pay for this great exemption, is considered as an in-house expense, to be absorbed in an inner term of a lengthy expression describing location, course, and speed. If you're interested, wait for my book upon navigation, currently all but in galley proofs, for a detailed account. Some were preoccupied with questions less modern. Where is Hobb headless in this aerial view? Dixon was not alone in wanting to know. What of the Shotten Dobby and the old hellcat of Raby with her black coach and six? She can rise above the landscape, too. How does an innocent cartographer deal with that? Professional courtesy is the usual rule, Emerson replied. You salute in the other her gift of flight and move on, briskly if possible. And vice versa, too? You're quite sure of that, sir? Tut, tut, alas, and what shall we do? Oh, the lamentations of Jeremiah! Have you been then squandering your precious skepticism over at Raby upon this gothical claptrap? Why, aye, and so he had, and even worse than that, he'd fallen into a fascination with the old hellcat herself, Elizabeth, Lady Barnard, who died back in 42 after a life of embittered family warfare over who was to inherit the castle, whose battlements she continued to walk with a pair of brass knitting needles whilst awaiting her coach. The great thing of these needles was that they glowed in the dark, because they were very hot, hotter than a coal fire, more like the fires of hell, which feed upon substances less easily named. 'Twas as a further conundrum presented to them to solve, or not solve, that Emerson wondered aloud, what yarn could she possibly be knitting with that would not burn at the touch of heat like that? Wool from a hell sheep? Those who tried to imagine it were rewarded, though in ways they later found difficult to describe. Many is the night young Dixon sees her up there, the angles between the two bright lines ever varying as she paces to and fro. One night, at last, probably, he says he is no longer sure, disappointed in early love, which is to say devastated, he decides, with nothing more to lose, that he'll go up and have a closer look. By now he knows the castle like a cat, no perch too precarious, no roof slate too slippery, as he goes a-flowing one to the next among holes upon the facial features of gargoyles known, perforce, with some intimacy, across counterscarps, to and through machicolations in the moonlight. If the spectre, without her coach, be relatively slow-moving, how difficult shall it be to spy upon her? That's if. As Dixon draws close, he can hear her muttering, never on time, always delayed, always another excuse. The late Lady Barnard, indeed. Yet what is the point of cursing the fool, eternally cursed as he was ever? By now there's a peculiar sound out in the night, bearing the same relation to hoofbeats as plucked strings to drum beats, and seeming to approach. Dixon must suppress a gasp. Assembling itself from the darkness about them, appears the most uncommonly beautiful coach he's ever seen. Its curves are the curves of a desirable woman, its lacquerings all a flash, bright as a wanton eye. Its coal-colored Arabs, scarcely sighing, bring it in a glide to a spot near her parapet, holding it then poised, hooves stirring in the empty air, above the grounds invisible in the darkness below, whilst the coachman, with a face as white as his livery is black, descends to the parapet to open her door. Late again, Trent. Sorry, milady, traffic. Traffic? She raises the brass needles above her head, one in each trembling fist, as if to strike. I've heard the lead horse went insane. I've heard the wife, she's not so clever this e'en night. I've heard the wind was in my teeth, and the clock ran down, and the dog made off with me coach whip. But this, Trent, this begins to approach the truly maddening. What possible traffic can there be above Cockfield Fell? Are we not, in fact, the only flying coach and six in the Palatinate? They come over from Herworth, milady, swarms of them. Oh, it's Emerson and that lot. Ragged children, swarms, quotha. You may as well have been delayed by a flock of ducks. Really, Trent, these excuses grow more and more enfeebled and tiresome, pari passu. What are you up to, honestly, when I leave you alone with this lovely machine? Trent? Come, come, you can tell her ladyship all. With an athletic readiness that surprises the young lurker, she vaults up into the quilted black velvet interior, and Trent swings shut the door and climbs smirking to his seat. Through the window, she leans out to stare back, unmistakably and directly at Dixon, and calls, "Perhaps another time, Jeremiah." They are gone, horses, perfect shine, curves and all, leaving Dixon's nape and shoulders mantled in unearthly cold. That is how he remembers first hearing of Emerson, though the legend by then was well underway in Durham. Though he keeps chuckling it away, Dixon also suspects he sought out Emerson from his desire to be one of those ragged kids, and that another time happened some evening when he and Lady Barnard were both aloft. Down there she held too much advantage. Altitude might help his odds. He didn't know whether he was planning seduction or combat, these, at 14, being the only categories of pleasure he recognized. That it might have been something else altogether would never occur to him until years later, at Castle Lepton, in the wilderness of America, well entangled in gambling debts, romantic intriguing, and political jiggery-pokery, all punctuated by a liver episode he may have worried himself into, unless 'twas all that drinking he was doing. "Ah, Mason," he cried, though Mason, who in fact was not doing too much better, lay snoring in a corner, "she has it all. Beauty, money, whatever else there is." Whilst yet in the steep mountains, they take to sledding in the year's early snowfalls upon folded pieces of tent canvas. One day, just as they start down a long slope neither can remember from earlier, coming the other way and climbing, an autumnal squall comes snapping up like a blanket being shaken into a spread of chill cloud, and snow begins abruptly, it seems, to fall. Both surveyors feel their velocity increasing ominously. "Hey, Dixon, still over there? Can you see where we're going?" "Snow's coming down too thick," Dixon calls from someplace, because of the change of acoustics between them, unmeasurable. Both shrill with the predicament, blind, together, separate, they plunge down the imperfectly remembered steep. They pass the commissary wagon, and one, then two more supply wagons, each braked in its snowy descent by a late-felled tree dragged behind, the drivers looking round wildly, the horses beginning to grow anxious, till Mason and Dixon are swept once again behind the stinging curtain of snow crystals. They hear voices ahead, then are suddenly zooming out of invisibility, in among the axemen, who, believing them pitiless, crazy predators in this place lonely as any in Ulster or the Rhineland, scatter for their lives back into the trees. The day is medium lit, the snow more fall than storm. The look of all things through the white descent is amplified. The brass of instruments back beneath canvas, the droppings of the horses, the glow of a clay pipe full of tobacco. Each is aware of how easily a tree unfelled, even a stump left high enough to protrude from the snow, rearing too quickly to swerve round, might mark their personal termini. "Dixon, can you hear me?" "I'm just here. I don't have to shout." "Look ye, I am going entirely too fast, and as the first derivative round here shows no sign of lessening, what I thought I'd do is self-brake. That is, lean over gradually like this until I fall over..." His voice abruptly fading behind, leaving Dixon alone to face whatever continues to rush upon him a snowflake's breadth ahead of his nose. "Eh, that's a bonny pickle that've put me in for fair." His reflections are interrupted by the seemingly miraculous advent, directly in his path, of a pile of cushions, usually located neath the wagon canopy, where they intervene twixt the instruments and the excursions of the secular roadway, but here rather set in the snowfall to air out, lest the telltale aura of tobacco smoke testify to a slothful and indeed unacceptable proximity of instrument bearers to instruments. Fate is fate, he supposes aloud, opening his arms to embrace this by no means discomfort-free heap of upholstery. Stogies, I believe, when all has subsided to a halt. Sir, replies the wagoner, Frederick Schess, my personal opinion of tobacco. Freddy, consider the crossing of paths here. Why, it has likely saved my life. Miraculous for fair. How can I report thee? Yet, at the same time, how can I commend thee for it? Cash is acceptable, calls Tom Hickman. Jug of corn now and then, to be pleasant, adds Matty Marine. They discharge the hands and leave off for the winter. At Christmastide, the tavern down the road from Harlan's opens its doors, and soon everyone has come inside. Candles beam everywhere. The surveyors, knowing this year they'll soon be heading off in different directions into America, stand nodding at each other across a punch bowl as big as a bathing tub. The punch is a secret receipt of the landlord, including but not limited to peach brandy, locally distilled whiskey, and milk. A raft of long icicles broken from the eaves floats upon the pale contents of the great rustic Monteith. Everyone's been exchanging gifts. Somewhere in the coming and going, one of the children is learning to play a metal whistle. Best gowns rustle along the board walls. Adults hold babies aloft, exclaiming, "This little sausage," and pretending to eat them. There are popped corn, green tomato mince pies, pickled oysters, chestnut soup, and kidney pudding. Mason gives Dixon a hat with a metallic aqua feather, which Dixon is wearing. Dixon gives Mason a claret jug of silver, crafted in Philadelphia. There are Conestoga cigars for Mr. Harland and a length of contraband Osnabrigs for Mrs. H. The children get sweets from a Philadelphia English shop, both adults being drawn into prolonged negotiations with their juniors as to who shall have which of. Mrs. Harland comes over to embrace both surveyors at once. Thanks for simmering down this year. I know it ain't easy. What a year, lass, sighs Dixon. Oh, like eating a bun, declares Mason. Chapter 53. The ascent to Christ is a struggle through one heresy after another, river-wise up country into a proliferation of sects and sects branching from sects, unto deism, faithless pretending to be holy, and beyond, ever away from the sea, from the harbor, from all that was serene and certain, into an interior unmapped, a realm of doubt. The nights, the storms and beasts, the falls, the rapids, the America of the soul. Doubt is of the essence of Christ. Of the 12 apostles, most true to him was ever Thomas. Indeed, in the Acta Thomae, they are said to be twins. The final pure Christ is pure uncertainty. He has become the central subjunctive fact of a faith that risks everything upon one bodily resurrection. Wouldn't something less doubtable have done? A prophetic dream? A communication with a dead person? Some few tatters of evidence to wrap our poor naked spirits against the coldness of a world where mortality and its agents may bully their way, wherever they wish to go. The Reverend Wicks Cherrycoke, Undelivered Sermons. She had found in her kitchen, the kitchen garden, the beehives, and the well, a joined and finished life. The exact life, perhaps, that our Lord intended she live. A life that was like a flirtation with the day in all its humorless dignity. She was at her window, in afternoon, peaceable autumn, everyone else in town at the venue, Seth too and the boys, when they came for her, as it seemed only for her. The unimagined dark men, the nakedness of the dark and wild men. Water in a kettle somewhere was crackling into its first roll. She risked looking at their faces. The only other place to look was down at the secret flesh, glistening, partly hidden, partly glimpsed behind the creased and odorous deerskin clouts. Yet for them to come for her, this far east of Susquehanna, this far inside the perimeter of peaceable life, was for the day to collapse into the past, into darker times. Was to be returned to and obliged to live through again something she thought all her community had transcended. Her lapse had been to ignore the surprising frailness of secular life. By imagining it to be Christian, she had meant to color it with the immortality of her soul in Christ, allowing herself to forget that turns of fortune in the given world might depend upon events too far out of her power. What twig fall, praise escape, unintended insult, might have grown, have multiplied, until there was nowhere else for them to have come. No one else to have come for, even still as she was, and spiritless, before that violent effect of causes unknown. The further they took her through the forest, away from her home and name, the safer she began to feel. Sure, they would have killed her back there, on the spot, if that's why they came. They were moving in a body, yet more slowly than one might have traveled without her. Not at all angry or cruel. Like a dream, just before the animals wake up, the German farms passed flowing by, the towns, Equinox, New Cana, Burger's Forge, until one morning, loud as the sea, stirred to apple cider turbulence from the rains, Susquehanna. How had they avoided the eyes of all the townsfolk and farmers between? The gentry out riding, the servants in the fields, how had her party found darkness and safety amid the busy white densities? And now they'd come to it, how did they mean to cross the river? There were boats waiting. At the time, she didn't find that as curious as their origins, for they were not Indian canoes, but French-built bateaux, framed in timbers, she was later to learn, that grow only in the far Illinois. And they crossed then, as simply as the thought of a distant child or husband might cross the zenith of a long day. She knew the instant they had passed the exact center line of the river. As she stepped to the western shore, she felt she had made herself naked at last, for all of them, but secretly for herself. Over the Blue Mountain, over Juniata, up into Six Nations country, into the roll of great earth waves ever northward, the billowing of the forests, in short-cycle repetition, overset upon the longer swell of the mountains. A population unnumbered of chestnuts, maples, locusts, sweet gums, sycamores, birches, in full green abandon. The songbirds went about their lives, the deer fell to silent arrows. The sound of Sunday hymns came from a distant clearing, then passed. The days went unscrolling. The only thing she was called on to do was go where they went. They did not bind or abuse, or unless they must speak to her. They were her express, she was their message. Northing, almost as she watches, trees, one after another, sometimes entire long hillsides of them, go flaring into slow, chill combustion. Sunsets, the colors of that hearth she may never see again, too often find her out, unprotected. Early snowflakes are appearing. Enormous flights of ducks and geese and pigeons darken the sky. The terrible massed beat of their wings is the roar of some great engine above. 'Tis withal a snowy owl year. The lemmings having suicided in the north, the owls are obliged to come further south in search of food. And suddenly white visitors from afar are everywhere, arriving in a state of mistrustful fatigue, going about with that perpetual frown that distinguishes them from the more amiably befizzed white gerfalcons. At the peaks of barns, the tops of girdled gray trees, gleaners of voles soaring above the harvested acres, with none of your ghostly hoo-hoo, neither, but low, embittered croaking, uttered in syllables often at the verge of human speech. The winds are turning meantimes ever colder, the leaves beginning to curl in and darken and fall. One day, having brought her to the shore of some vast body of water that vanishes at the horizon, they tell her she must get into a bark canoe. And for the first time she is afraid, imagining them all rowing out together into this yellow splendor, these painted indigo and salmon cloud formations, towards some miraculous land at the other side of what, even with a mild chop, would soon have battered the frail craft to pieces. Instead, keeping the shore ever in view, they continue north, till they enter a great river filled with a traffic of canoes and bateaux and barges, with settlements upon the banks, smoke ascending everywhere, white faces upon the shore, and a town, and another. For many weeks now, she has neglected to pray. She has eaten animals she didn't know existed, small, poor things, too trusting to avoid the snares set for them. Her captors have told her when and where she may perform every single action of her life. It is schooling, though she will not discover this till later. When they arrive at last in Quebec, the winter is well upon them. Though not as grand as its counterpart in Rome, yet in Quebec, the Jesuit College is palace enough. Travelers have described it as ascending three stories with a garret above, enclosing a broad central courtyard. Though, were she asked to confirm even this, she could swear to nothing. Perhaps there are more levels. Perhaps there is a courtyard within a courtyard, or beneath it. Perhaps a crypto-porticus, or several, leading to other buildings in parts of the city quite removed. Her arrival here passes too quickly for her to take much of it in. So deep in the night, in the snow, with the black nidor of the torches for her first incense, their light sending shadows lunging from corners and crevices and window reveals, the distant choiring like tuned shouts, the open looks of the men. At dawn, separate, she is taken into the refectory, where at each of the 100 places upon the bare tables is set an identical glazed earthen bowl of raspberries, perfectly ripe, though outside be all the dead of winter, and upon each table a jug of fresh cream from the shed. An old Indian serving man, who moves as if wounded long ago, showing not a trace of curiosity, brings in a kettle of porridge. She is not to have raspberries. She thanks the Lord, for who knows what unholy power might account for this unseasonable presence in its unnatural redness. The courtyard produces a constant echoing whisper that can be heard everywhere in the great residence. Every skin seems immediate to every other. Into the morning, scribes carry inkpots and quill sharpeners in and out of cells of many sizes, whose austerities are ever compromised by concessions to the Rococo. Boys in pointed hoods go mutely up and down with buckets of water and kindling. Cooks already have begun to quarrel over details of the noon meal. In his rooftop bureau, an astronomer finishes his night's reductions, writes down his last entries, and seeks his mat. Vigil keepers, meanwhile, arise and limp down to the ingenious college coffee machine, whose self-igniting roaster has, hours earlier, come on by means of a French clockwork device, which, the beans having been roasted for the desired time, then controls their transfer to a certain engine, where they are milled to a coarse powder, discharged into an infusing chamber, combined with water, heated exactly. Ecce cofea. She is taken, barefoot, still in Indian dress, into a room filled with books. Père de la Tube, a Jesuit in a violet cassock, speaks to her with a thick French accent and will not look at her face. Nearby, in smoothly kept silence, sits a colleague whose relentless smile and brightness of eye only the mad may know. Our guest, the Frenchman tells her, is a world-known philosopher of Spain, having ever taken interest in heretic women who turn to Holy Mother the Church. His observations upon your own case will, of course, be most welcome. So silently that she jumps, another man now, slighter and younger, in black silk jacket and trousers, has appeared in the room. When she makes out his face, she cannot reclaim her stare. As a small current of deference flows between the two Jesuits, the Spanish visitor takes from the messenger a tightly folded sheet of paper, sealed with wax and chops in two of the colors of blood. The messenger withdraws. She watches for as long as she can. You have never before seen a Chinese, child? She has assisted at more than one birth, has endured a hard-drinking and quarrelsome troop of menfolk. Who is this unfamilied man in a frock to call her child? She replies, "No, sir," in her smallest voice. "You must call me father. There'll be more than one Chinese here. You must learn to keep your eyes down." The college in Quebec is headquarters for all operations in North America. Kite wires and balloon cables rise into clouds, recede into aerial distances as, somewhere invisible, the Jesuit telegraphy goes ahead, unabated. Sealed carriages rumble in and out of the porte cochere. Horsemen come and go at all hours. Whenever the northern aurora may appear in the sky, rooftops in an instant are aswarm with figures in black. Certain of the crew seeming to glide like swifts ever in motion, others remaining still as statuary, the celestial flickering striking highlights upon the pale, damp faces. Rumors suggest that the priests are using the boreal phenomenon to send messages over the top of the world, to receiving stations in the opposite hemisphere. 26 letters, 9 digits, blank space for zero, a sergeant's voice instructing a platoon of novices. That suggest anything to any of you hammerheads? An array, 7x5 of... Think, nitwits, think. Lights. Behold, ye milling of sheep. He swings a lever. Above, against a gray deck of snow clouds, a gigantic latticework of bright and very yellow lights appears, 5 across by 7 down. Briskly stepping along ranks and files of smaller handles of ebony, he spells out the sequence, IDIOTS, in the sky, above their gaping faces. Visible for hundreds of miles. Everyone beneath, who can spell, now knows everything there is to know about you. But it's not all spectacle, all romance of electricity. No, there's insanely boring drudgery aplenty, too, mes enfants, for you're all to be sailors upon dry land. Explaining that, as the whole apparatus must stand absolutely still in the sky, before weather's unpredictable, it requires an extensive rigging, even more mysteriously complex than that of a naval ship. Lines must ever be shifted, individual winches adjust constantly the tension in stays and backstays and preventers, as the changing conditions aloft are signaled by an electrical telegraph to those below. A coordinator in a single-breasted soutane or cassock of black Bruges velvet and lined with wolverine fur stands upon a small podium before the set of ebony handles and indicators trimmed in brass, whilst Chinese attend to the rigging and specially trained Indian converts tend a peat fire so as to raise precisely the temperature of a great green prism of Brazilian tourmaline, a snarl as Medusa with plated copper cabling running from it in all directions, bearing the pyroelectrical fluid by which everything here is animated. More intense than the peat smoke, the smell of ozone prevails here, the musk of an unfamiliar beast, unsettling even to those who breathe it every day. In that harsh, sexual smell, in the ice-edged morning, she is led past them, northern winds beneath her deerskin shift, itching to risk raising her eyes just once to see who'll be watching. Do you think she understands? The visitor asks in rapid French. The other shrugs. She will understand what she needs to. If she seeks more... The two exchange a look whose pitiless weight she feels clearly enough. Men strain at cables that pitch steeply into the sky, the enormous rooftops anxiously a-scurry as before some invisible approach. Chinese seem to flit everywhere. Voices, usually kept low, are now and then raised. He has her arm. The other priest is behind them. She could not break free, could she, reaching with her arms, run to the roof's edge and into the air, upborne by friendly presences, as by brilliance of will, away across the roof slates and fortifications, wheeling beyond the range of all weapons, beyond the need for any obedience? The sun coming through, the river shining below, the great warrior's river keeping her course ever southwestward. Nor might any left behind on the ground see her again. Would they, passing above in the sky, the sleeves of her garment now catching light like wings, her mind no more than that of a kite, the wind blowing through. Careful, her head. She is upon her back, rain is falling lightly, a Chinese is squatting beside her, holding her forearm and talking to another Chinese, who is making notes in a small, ingeniously waterproofed book. 'Tis he, the same man she saw in the Jesuit's chamber. He smiles, or 'tis something in his face she sees and fancies a smile. God protect us, Père de la Tube is saying, from all these damnable fainting novices. Day after day, it never ends. The guest's ears seem to move. And yet, how many of us, posted upon missions more solitary, might find the event intriguing, and your situation here a paradise of charming catalepsies, and wonder, his manner bordering upon the strained, whatever you had to complain of. Ah, of course this isn't like the field, is it, Father, where occasions of sin are so seldom met with? No, here are rather opportunities without number, none of which may, of course, be acted upon. Wouldn't that depend, baring his teeth in a smile, upon whether she is to be a bride of Christ or stand in some other connection? As, he hesitates, as if for permission, his widow, a novice in Las Viudas de Cristo. Here the Spaniard kisses the crucifix of his rosary and pretends to pray a moment for the success of the sisterhood. Have your Indians collected you enough of these white roses that you might spare one? Of course, if you have a particular interest in this one. No, who, I? Not at all, in fact. Fingering the buttons down the front of his costume like beads of a rosary. I would settle for another. But we wouldn't hear of it, Father. Las Viudas must have her, no question. I shall do my best to speed the request up through hierarchy. How very generous. I go to mention you in my next report. The other inclines his head. She understands that she is being bargained for, having remained all the while upon her knees, disobediently gazing up at the men, waiting as long as possible to see which may be first to notice. Sister Blondel is a gypsy, a child of the sun, whom men keep mistaking for the very type of the British doxy, blowsy and cheeky as any who's ever delighted us in story or upon the stage. For a while, indeed, she worked as a Covent Garden sprite, finding herself in the company of every sort of man imaginable and not so, from quivering neophyte to depraved old coot. It did not take her long to accumulate a great spoil heap of mistrust for the breeched sex. Soldiers like ramrods and sailors like spars, mechanics and nabobs and gents behind bars. Girls, there's no sort of fellow I've ever passed by, not even those coolies out there in Shanghai. Tis, men have the sterling and sixpences too, so be where there's men, and tis mealtime for you. Mind the equipment as long as you can, and don't sell yourself cheap to some cheese-paring man. Ever since Adam stepped out of Eve's sight and didn't get back till the following night, men have been lying to women they bed, carefree as felons, yet easy to shed, singing. She is accompanied by a couple of sisters in close, yet for those days advanced harmonies. Beneath what seems but a taproom jig lies the same sequence of chords to be found in many a popular Protestant hymn. Though I was not present in the usual sense, nevertheless, I am a clergyman. Be confident, 'twas an utterly original moment musical, as they say in France. Then, as Blondel relates it, just as I was about to give up men, I discovered Jesuits. It was like finding Christ at last, a bolt of desire to find herself at last beyond desire. Yet not like renouncing anything. No, I loved the streets, love 'em ever. The excitement, the tail a minute scurrying, even the bullies, and despite the pox, girls stricken overnight, beauty gone. Sure, life's a gamble, just a day and night pass bank, isn't it? Why not look your best whilst the dice yet tumble? That's how I see it, don't you? She attends to her hair. Well, would you like me to fetch a mirror? That's what I mean. Oh. For the first time since she was taken, her voice stirs. She tries to smile, but finds herself short of breath. What must I look like? Whispering. Not quite ready for the ridotto, are you? Says Sister Grandchuse, with some solemnity. These are from berry vines, the quiet and dewy Sister Coiset examining the scratches upon her body closely. She nods. No marks from the Indians, if that's what you mean. They were uncommonly gentle with me. Although, Sister Grandchu's eyes sparkle like jasper. Must we guess, then? I stared often at the many ways they had inscribed their own skins, some of the pictures being most beautiful, others arousing in me strange flashes of fear, mixed with, it perplexes me to say, speak up, with feelings of desire. She sets her chin provocatively and gazes at them. Oh, dear, just from a couple of tattoos. Well, well, girls, whatever are we to do? 'Twill be the Silas for you, I'm afraid, my dear, and there's the first lesson already. Never discuss desire. Get that one sorted out. You'll be a good Catholic in no time. But you bade me... Shh, here it is. Here is what disobedient novices must wear. The Las Viudas Silas is a device suggested by Jesuit practice, worn secretly... Impossible, once secured, to remove, producing what some call discomfort, enough to keep thoughts from straying far from God. If God were younger, more presentable, murmurs Crozier, we'd be thinking about him all the time, and we shouldn't need this. her gaze inclining to the hothouse rose, deep red, nearly black, whose supple, long stem is expertly twisted into a breech clout, to pass between the labia as well as round the waist, with the blossom, preferably one just about to open, resting behind, in that charming cusp of moistness and heat, where odors of the body and the rose may mingle with a few drops of blood from the tiny green thorns, and flashes of pain, whose true painfulness must be left for the penitent to assess. Of course, this is all for the purpose of keeping her attention unwaveringly upon Christ. Considering what Christ had to go through, Jesuits are all too happy to point out, it isn't really much to complain about. Sister Grandchoux stands behind her, gripping her by the arms. "It could have been worse," whispers little Sister Crozier. "Not all Indians are so honorable." She kneels at the captive's feet, holding the device, her fingertips already pricked and reddened, and cannot keep from directing wide-eyed glances upward. "All right, dear," nods Sister Blondel. "Step right in, and mind those long limbs." She should be objecting, loudly if she must, but when has she ever done so before? And to offenses, it now seems to her, far more grave than this. Instead, her bare feet go creeping, one after the other, like docile birds, toward the waiting trap of the psyllus, and then each, lifting, fluttering, passes into the realm of thorns. Later, they give her soothing gums to rub into the tiny wounds. The odor rises as the rubbing goes on, a single church-like odor of incense, ungrounded by candle wax or human occupancy, meant for heaven, a fume rising in transmutation. She is shorn of all hair, from head to crooks. "You must begin," they advise her, "absolutely naked. If you're good, if you learn what you are taught, you may someday be allowed a wig, a child's wig, of course, perhaps a boy's. You look enough like one now." "Farm work, madame. Ah, don't be insolent." Having already seen other sisters going about in elaborate wigs that she imagines must be quite in the current Parisian mode, she is soon wondering how she might look in one of these powdered confections. One night she sneaks into the room where, ranked upon shelf after shelf, all the wigs are kept, each upon its elegant wig stand made of a strangely shaded ivory. Mischievously, she idles away one cat hour and then another, prowling, peering, crouching, hardly daring to touch the white, bevorticed objects, each more desired than the last. When she does at length reach forward, take one to her breast, slip it on to her own shaven pate, and only then think of finding a mirror and then some light to see by, she is flanked in the instant by strong presences, whose faces she slowly recognizes in the dark as those of Blondel and Crozier. "Took her time about it, I must say." Sooner or later, they all do it. Mistress Piety here is as vain as any Portsmouth whore. "Yet prettier than most," whispers Crozier. She blushes as they remove the wig in the near dark, and she supposes, with a private frown, she'll never see it again. Her eyes follow it back to its wig stand, which she notices for the first time, with a chill, is directing at her a socketed stare. She recognizes it belatedly as a human skull. Resolved never again to be called a fainting novice, she looks about. Yes, every gay elaboration in the room rests upon a staring skull. She lets out her breath in a great sigh and refrains from fainting. The model, the wolf of Jesus addressing a room full of students, is imprisonment. Walls are to be the future. Unlike those of the Antichrist Chinese, these will follow right lines. The world grows restless. Faith is no longer willingly bestowed upon authority, either religious or secular. What pity! If we may not have love, we will accept consent. If we may not obtain consent, we will build walls. As a wall, projected upon the earth's surface, becomes a right line, so shall we find that we may shape, with arrangements of such lines, all we may need, be it in a crofter's hut or a great mother city. Rules of precedence, routes of approach, lines of sight, flows of power. "Hold, hold," objects an auditor. "Is this not to embrace the very ortholatry of the Roman Empire, that depraved worship of right lines intersecting at right angles, which at last reduced to the brute simplicity of the cross upon Calvary?" Padre, Padre, which Rome is it, again, the Jesuits are sworn to? A grim smile. What injury that we are not in Spain. He is no longer surprised at impiety or disrespect, having found them only too prevalent upon this side of the ocean. Yet there remains little choice. Too much of Europe is unsafe now for any Jesuit. America is perplexing. Though all the world's expelled and homeless be welcome here, no true soldier of Christ could ever find easy refuge among these people, for whom heresies flow like blood in the bloodstream, keeping them at the work of their day as blood might keep others warm. Yet heresy loses its force in these provinces, this far west, with sects nearly as numerous as settlers. To pursue through the American quotidian every act of impiety he might find would be to fight upon more flanks than any could reckon. Where would time remain for la obra? Perhaps there is no disjunction, he has nonetheless continued, and men, after all, want Rome, want her, desire her as both empire and church. Perhaps they seek a way back to the single realm as it was before Protestants and Protestant descent and the mindless breeding of sect upon sect. A portrayal in the earthly daylight of the soul's nostalgia for that undifferentiated condition before light and dark, earth and sky, man and woman. A return to that holy silence which the word broke and the multiplexity of matter has ever since kept hidden before all but a few resolute explorers. Hold, hold! Is it a Chinese motif we begin to hear? An entire room full of students transferred here from the University of Hell. If Chinese feng shui be forbidden, how may we study such metaphysics as this without risk of reprimand? The risk is not so much to your backside as to your soul. Can any tell me, why must we fight their abhorrent magic? A ripple of giggling. Pues entonces, I was a student once, too. I remember passing around the same withered packets of paper you have been reading in secret, now unfolded and refolded 100 times. Secrets of the Chinese wizards. Aha, even to the name. Some of you are learning how to paint the symbols, perhaps even beginning to experiment with combining them in certain ways. I know, fellows, I know everything that passes here. Another of the 1,000 or so wonderful things about the sacrament of penance is its utility in group situations like yours. Someone always confesses, or in plain Spanish, siempre alguien derrama las judías. What's he saying? Something about scattering the Jewesses. Now 'tis Kabbalism. In a moment he'll be rattling an ancient Hebrew, and perhaps we ought to have a plan. For subduing him, you mean? Actually, I meant a plan for getting out of the room. Why prevent the Chinese from practicing feng shui? Because it works, the Wolf of Jesus is explaining. How then, if it works, should we not be studying it? It carries the mark of the adversary. It is too easy, not earned. Too little of the load is borne by the practitioner, too much by some force invisible, and the unknown price it must exact. What do you imagine those to be that must ever remain so unreferred and unreferable to Jesus Christ? And as his soldiers, how can we ever permit that? It was an earlier, simpler time, children, when many grew quite exercised indeed over questions of doctrine. There is deep, throat-snarling hatred, for example, as the Wolf of Jesus instructs them. The Christless must understand that their lives are to be spent in servitude. If not to us, then to Christians even less godly, the kings, the enterprisers, the adventurers, chartered and piratical. What of those that we may convert? The priest makes a dismissive gesture, his knuckles flashing pale in the candlelight. Conversion is no guarantee of a Christly life. Jews are converted. Savages, English wives, Chinese, what matter? Once converted, all then revert. Each one, at the end of the day, is found somewhere, often out in the open, among ancient stones, repeating without true faith the same vile rituals. And where is he? Where are his forgiveness, his miracles? He is upon his knees in apparent consultation. The students, after a while, begin to whisper together, and soon the place is chattier than a coffee house. The Spanish visitor continues apart.
Chapter 54. There came an evening during my novitiate when, after being fed but lightly, I was taken to a chamber, and there laced into an expensive corset, black as midnight, imported, I was told, from Paris, from the very workshop of the corsetier to the queen. They painted my face into a wanton sister of itself, showing me in a hand mirror, 'twas a woman I'd never seen before, whom upon the instant sinfully I desired. I allowed the Macaus to hear my surprised little gasp as they brought out undergarments for me that might, Blondel assured me, make a French whore think twice. The Chinaman likes these, they informed me, as firmly I was hooked and knotted into this uniform of most shamefully carnal intent, which framed but did not veil my intimate openings. I went this way and that upon the balls of my feet, lace trimmings aflutter in tiny steps of perplexity. Chinamen? What Chinamen? One of the principal duties of a widow of Christ is to charm the Chinese. Soon you'll begin your studies in their language. Eventually, you'll go there for a year or two. China? Hold still. We, everyone here, has served upon that station. You'll love it, cried Blondel. The food they eat there is delicious beyond belief. Shrimps with hot chilies and peanuts. Sliced chicken in garlic and black bean sauce. Cold sesame noodles. Sweet biscuits with messages folded inside upon paper you can eat. Ah, making myself hungry just thinking about it. The wicked French nuns all took a coordinated dance step together, turned and shook their fingers. Basest form of desire, Blondel. Even to speak of it suggests a failure of self-restraint I am all but obliged to report. Oh, get on. Have you never been starved for something that tastes like something instead of this gruel we're ever fed? Nonetheless, sister, I took the moment to examine my new adorned limbs, running fingertips where I could not see, trying to be my own looking-glass. It earned me a slap and some time upon my knees. Charming the Chinaman was serious business round here.